Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Make sure we're working.
Oh yeah, that's facing you. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fucking warm in here.
It is warm in here.
It is warm in here. I wonder, is there any way?
There are a lot of sound controls, but no climate controls.
I think it's a building thing, not a room
on the
thing.
Weekend. I
yeah,
think on the weekend.
It is. Yeah. They just want to switch out.
On the weekend, they don't want you hanging out too long, so they.
Yeah, the worst is being in an edit bay on the weekend because it's just fucking having the Avid in there just heats up everything.
Ugh.
Fucking shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been stuck doing that before.
Yeah, it's the worst.
You're sitting in a tiny little room sweating like, oh, I don't care anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Do you like that?
Oh, yeah, I get some.
Are we recording already?
We are.
You're amazing. You always start, and then I don't know that we've started.
Yeah.
And then I always go, are we recording?
And
that's apparently the way we start every...
Very.
That's basically the intro song.
It is. Are we recording now? Rob Zombie's here on the podcast.
Did we start yet?
Yeah, we've already started. We've dragged you into the fabulous Comcast boardroom.
It's actually much nicer than I thought it would be. It sounds kind of shitty.
I know it does.
But actually, it's pretty nice.
You know, it's still... Listen, podcasting...
Well, this isn't the glass one.
No, this isn't the glass room. Sometimes we're recording a glass room, and it sounds like you're in a goddamn echo chamber.
Do people watch you, like the Today Show?
They wave in the background.
Yeah,
signs.
It's my birthday.
Yeah. People with signs that say, we don't know you.
Yeah, people with jetpacks and people who can levitate. Telekinetics hover outside the window when we wave to them. You know, it's funny because I feel like podcasting now is... It's just a great, like, a lot of people do it. There's some great podcasts out there. But still, for some reason, when you ask someone to do your podcast, I always just feel weenie when I'm asking. I wish I could come up with a different name.
Feel weenie.
You want to do my show?
Want to do our internet radio show?
That sounds worse. That sounds way worse.
Well, everyone does it because they feel bad. They go, ooh, Harley sure has fallen on hard
times. Sure
he's only got a podcast
He's dragging behind the entertainment truck.
Yeah, I love it how it's like, you know, basically it's like, oh, I hope that works out for you. No, it works out. We do it week to week. We have fun. We talk to people. Yeah, I hope it works out.
Yeah.
It's currently working out.
Chris went through all the Terminator 3 money.
the day after he shot Terminator 3.
At lunch.
He used all the money on the ticket home from
what
set.
What was your character's name? I remember they actually had a name like Dr. Something.
Oh, I wish it was Dr. Something.
It
was Engineer Number 2.
I thought it was actual name.
No.
Dr. Engineer Number 2.
Maybe I just imagined
that. But you made Skynet. What could be better?
We don't know what's happening with all these robots. They should just call me Expositional Scientist Number 2. Here was a fun thing about Terminator, about getting the part in that movie, was that...
It was the worst one?
Well, I'm not going to...
Not yet.
I'm not going to say that.
It wasn't.
I didn't see Salvation. I didn't see Terminator Salvation.
I can't remember.
But I had gone in. I was really at the height of my doughy alcohol days.
I believe that was
House of a Thousand Corpses. Yeah, I was about to say.
You know, it really worked for Jerry though. Like being a fat drunk.
Well, it
really
didn't work for some of the. I believe you actually didn't work for a couple weeks.
Yeah,
and came back.
Yes.
Fatter.
I think maybe I did come back a little bit fatter.
So if you do watch the movie, as your character is being starved and tortured, he is actually getting fatter. I could say that now because you're slim and trim.
My character relies on. Oh, that's so terrible to know that people thought about that back then. Like, there was probably a meeting where, like,
have
him
grow
Hardwick
a beard and
fatter.
Create the illusion of a jawline.
Well, technically, when people are being tortured, they're going to store more fat because. You know, they're just going into a hibernation mode, exactly, Rob. Yeah, so exactly. I was just
thanks for playing it so real.
It was a character choice on my part.
No, they were also feeding you, like the dream child of, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's
where they
right.
fed you, but
yes.
then they also tortured
those
you.
Those scenes were cut out.
Well, that's what happened. So for Terminator 3, I had gone in to audition for this crappy movie called, like, Biker Boys or something, where it was basically like Fast and the Furious on motorcycles,
nice.
Which is, I'm 100%
sure
positive
it.
How it was pitched.
Yeah.
And so I go in, and I don't look good at all. I'm doughy and blotchy, and I've got that curtain hair hanging down on my face. And so I auditioned to be a biker boy, and they're like, you know, I don't know. Hey, do you think you could play like an engineer? Like, it was so funny to go from, hey, sexy biker to, well, how about a fat engineer?
So you went into audition for the biker boys, and they were also casting Terminator 3 at the same time?
Yeah, and then so I got that I got that small...
Oh, I thought you meant an engineer on the bikes.
No. No.
There you go, biker boys. It's all fixed up. Real nice, just like how you like it.
I was too fat to be a bike engineer, but not too fat to be a robot engineer.
Oh, robots.
Robots. So, yeah, the corpses shoot was fun, and then you shaved my head, and then
that was the best part.
Tore all the flesh off my body.
I still remember the highlights for me are trying to do a life cast on you.
Oh my god!
And it was funny because some people get really claustrophobic and freak out when you put a life cast on them.
Well, that's like everything.
I'm one of those guys. I didn't realize it was going to happen. But it doesn't sound like it's going to be that big of a deal.
I once heard Shia LaBeouf complaining about that at the Grove.
What?
Complaining about having to sit for another life cast.
Why did they life cast him for the Grove?
He's like not for the Grove, but at the Grove. And
why
were
you that close to him?
I'm not fucking doing another one. They can just use the one from Indiana Jones. And I was like, all right.
You were like, all
yeah,
I said to you was hello.
Yeah. $10 million is not enough to get another life cast.
Oh, Jesus. Well, what happens when you're like, I didn't realize it was going to be like that. They just say, oh, they're just going to put some, you know, paste on your face and then it'll dry and then you'll be fine. I'm like, all right. Well, first, they stick those straws in your nose and then you immediately go, oh, something not awesome is about to happen. And then they start pasting it on your face and then it covers your eyes and it's as dark as you've ever seen. I mean, it's as dark as you've ever perceived with your own eyes.
Darkness.
And then so you start to sweat a little bit. You're like, okay, no, I think I can do this.
Hey, Wayne, how long is this going to take?
Yeah, I know, Wayne Tom. And then he covered up my left ear, and it just went like deadly silent, like you're being
so
held underwater.
Sensory deprivation.
Complete sensory deprivation, and I've never felt so more claustrophobic in my life.
I saw that they did that in The Little Chocolatiers, which is that show on TLC about the little people that run the chocolate shop.
Sounds like a not real show. Is that real?
It's TLC, you know? It's like little kids.
The little channel?
Little people that have too many kids. It's like every show.
Wow!
But like, yeah, but they like did a like a crown like not a crown like they just molded his
little
entire
head.
Face. Yeah.
Why don't they have a midget dating show called Small Chance, and then and then you can go out with.
I just recently I had an idea for about a movie for an Indian baseball team that almost makes it to the big playoff game, but they don't make it. So it's called Close But No Sitar.
All right, how about this? Two mentally challenged twins open a casino in Vegas. Double downs. Come on, you guys.
I heard Mike Burns, I think, had this joke. It was they should call people that are obese, that they should say that they have double down syndrome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not double down syndrome?
No, double downs. That's the new KFC. Chicken yep. Sammy.
For people with Down syndrome, right? That's what that sandwich is for.
Because
you would have
people...
to be to put that in your body.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So anyway, as Wayne Toth was smearing all the stuff on my face, he said, you might get a little claustrophobic, so just let me know. And by the way, you only have to keep it on for like 10 minutes. And I couldn't do it. He covered up my left ear. And I was like, we're going to have to not do this anymore. And I wiped it off my face, like throwing it on the ground and had a little bit of a freak out.
Yeah, because I remember calling him later. How'd it go with Chris? And he never wants to say anything. That's so good.
But they still, so basically he cast it in pieces. And then put
did
it
he
together.
Do it? Okay.
Yeah.
There was that. And then the other thing was, remember we spent about 15 minutes getting you strapped down to the operating table?
Oh, and then I had to pee.
And then you had to pee.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus
yeah.
Christ. Yeah. All that beer had to come out, huh?
Yeah. Had to make room for more. Yep.
Yeah. Hey, I can't get up. Can you guys grab me some whiskey?
Can you just... Well, I'm on an operating table. Can you just stick in the IV and then just run into my, arm? Well, that was fun because we... That was the second... That the whole experience of that movie was so fascinating to me. You called me in like the summer of 99, I think, and you're like, hey, I'm writing a movie, and there's a character who's a sarcastic asshole, and you'll be perfect for it. I'm like, awesome. And then I thought it'll just be one of those things.
Happen.
Yeah, well, because so many times, you know, like you talk to people and you get caught up in the ideas and they sound great. And then for whatever reason, because the business is just a steeplechase of failure most of the time, stuff just doesn't happen. But it really did. And you know, you made the movie for not a lot of money. And then Universal gave you more. And then you shot the second ending. Did you ever release the original ending on anything?
No. I mean, I don't even know where anything is. It was one of those things that everyone's like, oh, you should put out the deluxe version, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, who the hell knows where any of that film is?
Oh, it's just gone?
I don't know where that is.
It's just all gone.
I have it.
That's weird. Yeah. You found it at a Salvation Army, right?
Yep, sure did.
I love it.
What's in this dusty box?
I've actually had that happen before. Kids like, hey, look, I found the trailer at a yard sale on 35 millimeter. What the hell did you get that? Whose yard sale?
Send it to me.
Yeah, it's weird.
But I love the idea that the studio would call you in and tell you you're spending too much money and you would say like, it's a lunch that they catered for like $1,000 that they were charging the production.
Universal was funny. They didn't care about nothing. I mean, if you ever get a job, you don't know how good you have it till you don't have that job.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was that place where like, oh, we need more trailers. Give us this. Like, I guess you just ask and it arrives. And every movie since then has been like... I don't think so. Yeah, but Universal just that thing was bleeding money.
And then they didn't release it because of the weird anti-violence campaign.
That was a weird time, yeah. They didn't want anything to do with horror movies or anything, and then they suddenly did. Did us no good.
Did they put out Hostel?
No, but they had, I think they did Dawn of the Dead and everything else. Like they had, you know, once, but I mean, that was when we did it, 2000 or something?
Yeah, we did it in 2000.
For that brief moment, no one seemed to give a crap about horror movies.
And then for, it was
and
only,
suddenly it was like a big boom again.
Yeah, they all of a sudden started up. And then they got watered down, like, instantly. Like Hostel came out, and everyone talked about how, like, oh, it's back. And then instantly, I think the next year, like, there was, like, a whole LA Weekly thing. Is like, torture porn horror is too much, isn't it? Like, it's instantly, yeah. Everyone gets tired of it so fast every time.
No one told the Saw franchise.
Yeah.
They're still making them.
Yeah, I mean, they still haven't made as many Saws as they ever did Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th.
Oh, they're at 6 now, right?
Saw. Friday the 13th is 8. No, 10 if you count Jasonks. And
when you're working with that type of material, it's easier to...
Critters went to 4.
Jason
had 4
in space.
Critters.
So do you... Now you pretty much... I mean, I think the Universal thing was probably the best thing that could have happened.
It worked out good. I mean, you know what? I like talking about it because it became like a George Lucas situation. We kind of had this master plan that we formed after the fact where first we thought, let's try to get someone else to buy the movie, but everyone didn't want it. Which was, you know, whatever. That took a year and a half. Then we thought, like, well, I guess our only chance is to convince Universal that the movie is so incredibly worthless that we can buy it back at a reasonable price. And it really went from like, well, we want our money back. We want $14 million for this thing. And I was like, well, we'll take 12.
Well,
we'll take 10. We'll take 7. And we're like, better keep going. But as the months went by and 2 years later, like, how's $100,000 sound?
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
It was some ridiculous number when we got it back and immediately sold it to the Lionsgate.
Nice. So it was basically it was the major league plan where you run the franchise into the ground so you could move the
pretty
team
much
to Florida.
Yeah, and it was great because they're like, well, the merch is meaningless, so we won't
get those Indians out of Cleveland.
It was good though; it worked out good. But it's funny though; that's a funny movie because now it's been long enough that you know when it came out, pretty much everyone hated it. You know, and you know they think they singled out your performance in particular as ruining.
Did you single that specifically?
Oh, that's my new phone.
Is that your phone?
Which I guess I should have muted, but who cares?
Classic ringtone, Rob.
If the I don't know how to get it off there, but it doesn't. And I actually can't get it.
I think a classical musician is trying to reach you on the telephone.
Hold on.
Imagine if you could ring through like that. Like
it's Sherry, so she will actually.
They would say, "Start your ring
and
now,"
over.
And then you would just yell at the phone, and it would be playing. Like if I was calling you, I'd be like, "Chris, it's me. Answer, Chris, it's me." And that was
Oh, that wouldn't
That wouldn't be remotely irritating. That is terrible.
Actually, you could do that.
You could do that if you wanted to, because you can like specifically have ringtones for people.
No, no, I mean live. Like a live ringtone.
Oh.
Meaning so you're shouting
when
through.
When I call,
right.
I'm shouting right, through right. and it's playing that.
Shout Tones by Ed Hardy. Shout
terrible tones. Idea number 473.
Really? 472?
Do they think my fingers are here?
Oh, you got a new BlackBerry there.
I can't type anything, so if I text you anything, every single word will be spelled wrong.
Well, you find that's a new BlackBerry you have there.
I got it yesterday.
Nice.
I had the Sidekick 2.
You're the Sidekick 2 for a long time.
For like 4 years, and every time I brought it out, people thought it was a joke.
You know,
I was still using it.
It's a hilarious phone, Rob. Yeah, where's your real one?
Let me bring out my Sidekick.
I remember I had the same like dual cassette recorder and vinyl and record player for like 10 years when I was growing up, and now if someone has a phone for like 2 years, you're like, oh, you still got that one, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they don't have it. They get it, and they go, oh, crap, the new one's coming out.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't take this one out of the wrapping yet.
Technology.
The only reason I got a new phone was I was using my Sidekick still. The volume didn't work anymore, so I would have to put on a speakerphone and hold the speakerphone right to my ear.
Mm-hmm.
And even to barely hear people.
Even the Sidekick.
That works, right?
Even the Sidekick knew it shouldn't be working anymore. It was slowly trying to poison itself. Yeah. Like, I got it. Yeah. Please let me pass on to the other side.
All my friends are dead.
I want to go.
I'm so lonely.
So let's see. I first met you in 1995. I interviewed. It was what year that I got to work the Video Music Awards.
Yep.
Which was a lot of fun.
And you interviewed me. We were playing, and I remember Bon Jovi was playing Times Square, and we seemed to think that was very funny.
We thought that was hilarious. Even in 95, we were making Bon Jovi slams.
Yeah, big time.
Back in 95.
Still seemed funny.
And I didn't really know much about anything at that point, so when they're like, hey, you're going to interview White Zombie, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, random rock band, sure. and then... Like when you're
because they said Chris Hardwick's going to interview us. Man, whatever, random MTV VJ guy.
No, sure. Exactly. I'm sure you didn't have any idea who I was.
No, I did because I had seen Singled Out, and I actually had thought you had done the one episode where you were wearing the Devo hat.
Yes.
And I thought this show seems horrible, but that guy's actually really funny.
Oh, that's nice.
That's exactly so what
even,
I thought.
Even, yeah, you know, like I could tell. I thought it was funny because you did not even slightly mask your contempt for the show,
no.
or the contestants,
no.
in any way.
Well, that show,
or Jenny McCarthy or Carmen Electra.
Yeah.
Well, I
and I found that to be very funny.
I did like Jenny and Carmen. The contestants, I was completely.
No, I know.
They were full of people that I loathed in college. It was just like this
kind of frat,
you know, like this Greek system fucking organism that was belched out by the asshole of the Greek system, and so they was just full of those people, and I hated them all in college, and so I was just sort of the angry nerd who just started commenting under his breath into the microphone because I knew the people at home would hear it, but it was too loud on the set, so no one could hear me saying shit about them on the set. I'm like, this will get. I learned that pretty fast,
But within
like 5 seconds of talking to you, the antenna went up and I'm like, oh shit, this guy's fucking funny. Like
two smartasses that hate everything.
That's right.
and we bonded on that for years.
We bonded on that, and then we did that contest in Indiana where they broadcast from some kid's house.
Oh yeah,
in
that was brutal.
And we just ended up talking about comic books and movies and stuff. And I'm like, holy shit, Rob Zombie's awesome! And then we became friends. We became friends after that.
Yep.
And then here we are.
It's really sweet, you guys.
Podcasting.
Yeah. Podcasting. Look how far you guys have come with your friendship.
Where did it all go?
One day we're at MTV working at Universal. Chris, now we're podcasting from an abandoned building on Sunday. your master plan to phase yourself out is almost complete.
Slowly, one project at a time. I'll make this business forget about me if it's the last thing I do. Podcast.
Chris who?
It is complete.
And he just fades away.
Now my training is complete. Pretty soon I'll just be in my fucking garage with like an Art Bell radio just fucking talking about aliens. But
Art Bell.
Art Bell.
I haven't thought about Art Bell in 15 years.
Well, now you have.
Yeah.
So how does it... You guys, you've been in the business for a while now. You guys, I didn't realize your first album was in like 85.
Yeah.
So what, Now that you've been doing this for a while, how has everything changed? I mean, what was the music business in the 80s? Because people always talk about, like, oh, it was awesome. They just threw money at everything, and now everything sucks.
They didn't throw it at me. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the secret to my success is doing everything the wrong way first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still the same way. Like, I don't care about anything.
Yeah.
Like, I'll have a meeting. Like, oh, you're going into some big studio, have a meeting. I'll walk in for 5 seconds, and if I don't like the attitude, I'm over it.
Yeah.
Like, I just can't get with the, like, walking around, kissing everyone's ass, trying to get a job thing.
I totally agree with you, Rob.
You're doing it right now.
Oh, you're right, Chris.
Jonah, you're doing it to me.
I'm really a dumb idiot, you guys.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, that's how the band started. Well, I was oblivious to everything in the world and just kind of do your own thing. And somehow, I think more now than ever, though, I find I keep getting offered these weird, really, like, mainstream sort of directing gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they like is that you don't give a crap. That's... Loses some jobs, though.
Yeah. But I guess...
Because you reek of you're too much trouble to deal with. And not because you're trouble. Like, you'll show up on time and you'll nail it, but you won't be a studio puppet.
Right.
Which is what they really want a lot of times.
Yeah, they just want someone to, like, take the reins while they're not looking.
Yeah, I mean, they really want to direct it and they really want to control it. And they just want you to jump when they say jump.
I won't say any names, but didn't you say that one studio head asked you if you owed a lot of money on stuff?
Yeah, they asked me if... Do you have a lot of debt? And I said, no, I'm fine. I made a lot of money. And you could tell the look on the face was like, damn it. How are we going to control this guy now? He's not motivated by money.
Wow.
Yeah, because you guys.
Do you need this? How bad do you need this?
Okay, this is $100 in my hand.
If you could go from there to there. No, but it's funny because I do see a lot of certain studios, and everyone knows which one that is. Their thing is to tie up young directors who are broke, for the most part, and torture them.
Until their will
totally
is ground
their lives,
to a nub.
Break their will and torture them. But they have nothing, it's like they have to do it because, if you're living in an apartment trying to pay your rent, you're at the mercy of, because you always think, like, oh, if I just do this, it'll make this work. Yeah. And it doesn't. I used to think it was, you could get away with that a little bit. Like, if you were like a team player, people would respect you and be like, great, this guy's always here on time and he's ready to work. But they just take you for granted. It's more like if you're difficult and you go, you know what, fuck you, I don't need your fucking movie. Like, we gotta have this guy.
Yeah, squeaky
you know,
wheel.
It's really a drag, you know.
Yeah, I always go back and forth because I try to be nice to everybody. I feel like work should be a fun environment. Like, this is
me too.
Yeah. Like, yeah, we
too.
Get. Oh, and by the way, working on Corpses with You and Halloween was so much fucking fun because. You know, you have the scene the way you write it, and then you go, okay, you guys just fuck around and have fun, and, like, it's a completely...
I think if everyone's having fun, like, it will make the outcome of, like, the product, like, that much better.
Yeah.
Or it's like if everyone feels comfortable enough to kind of, like, maybe submit an idea or, like, just feel comfortable just being around everyone else, like, they will only make it seem better.
Yeah.
I mean,
ultimately, it doesn't matter who gets the best joke as long as you get the best joke.
As long as the best joke is on...
It's on screen. Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, but it's amazing, too. I mean, I didn't really realize that. I mean, that was always the way I looked at it. Like, whoever's got the best idea wins.
Right.
I don't care if it came from me. But, I mean, it's amazing. A lot of actors, they were so shy to ask, like, do you mind if I change this one word?
Right.
You mean the? No.
I was thinking about pronouncing it the.
But some people get that crazy, like, I want it exactly, like this. And sometimes that doesn't work because just that person can't say that in a way that sounds right. It just seems weird. And
when we shot Halloween 2, the scene that I did was with Malcolm McDowell, and and you call me and you were like, hey, are you still friends with Saget? And I go, well, I haven't talked, because Bob Saget and I were drinking buddies for a long time back in the old days. Saget and Hardwick tearing up the town. I have so many weird stories about just turning up after hours at a bar with Saget and running into, like, Dabney Coleman and Harry Dean Stanton, who both were really fucked up, and Harry Dean Stanton drove anyway another after hours place. And then finally Bob and I were like, I don't think we can keep up with Dabney Coleman and Harry Dean Stanton. But those are the old days. And I said, well, I haven't talked to Bob, recently. And you go, well, I need, I need someone who would make a great couch guest to, to give Malcolm's character shit. And I go... Well, I've been hanging out with Weird Al lately, and you go like, you gotta fucking call him right now. And then so, 2 days later, he's on a plane and we're shooting the scene. But I loved watching Al nerd out over Malcolm.
Yeah. It was, and I love the fact that Malcolm had no idea who he was.
Mr. Weird.
It's like, He takes you aside, like, who is this guy?
So, Malcolm, what was Malcolm like to work with? Because I found him to be a complete delight, but I know that if he doesn't like you, then he will tell you.
I don't know. I mean, I before I worked with Malcolm, I was kind of like not sure, because you can't tell. You go, that guy could either be really funny and fun, or he could be a terror.
Right.
But he's just been amazing every time. From the moment I met him, you know, we went out to lunch and we had a blast. And from then on, he's just like down for everything and just loves it. I mean, I can't imagine him being a problem. I really can't in any way. I mean, he's always was a blast and always awesome.
He just seems
but
like
then
a guy.
Maybe he was just, you know, I know some actors that I've worked with at first are a little weird, and then they and difficult, then they realize, wait a minute, I'm actually having a good time. And then they totally shift their mode. So I think a lot of actors that have been around have been in a lot of different situations come in guarded sometimes, because they go, wow, this may be another fucking bunch of bullshit I'm going to hate, so why should I come? You know, or as Danny Trejo likes to say, you know, sometimes I show up, I don't bring my A game. I bring my B game. I can't do a good Danny, but, you know, he purposely knows.
Wow.
But, no, Malcolm was always kick-ass. And
so, guys, I'm sure you're able to melt David Caruso's stone walls.
Well, Malcolm and Caruso, that didn't go down so good.
Oh, shit. So in case you guys don't know, Rob recently directed an episode of CSI Miami.
That didn't work so
and
good.
And I think it was... My impression was that it took more of an emotional toll just directing that one episode of television than like any of the movies.
It really did.
That you've worked on.
I mean, it was, you know, it was a great opportunity. I don't want to say anything bad, because, you know, Marco Black, who you might remember.
Oh, Marco was great. Yeah,
He's a producer on CSI now, and that's why he called me to do CSI. And you know, it was a great opportunity, but TV's just not my thing. But it's weird, you know. Movies, you build it from the ground up. It's your crew. It's your everything. It's your baby. TV's like, hey, I'm walking in there. These guys have been doing it for 8 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're certainly not going to change anything in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. I want to hear a Malcolm Caruso story. Is it?
Well, Malcolm came in with the attitude, a fun-loving attitude, that he was kind of going to torture him. Because he had heard the stories about how David might be. So just, you know... The scene, I don't know what he does or doesn't do on purpose sometimes, but just one of those things where, you know, when it's time to do David's close-up, they're on it. And when it's time to do David's close-up, Malcolm had already walked to the bathroom. You know, like, and everyone's like, oh, no. Or, like, just stuff where, like, there was one scene where, you know, Horatio comes in and he's supposed to scold Malcolm's character. And I just took Malcolm aside and said, whatever you do, do not let this character get the upper hand on your character, no matter how hard they try in the scene. So they walk in, and Malcolm's playing like a lawyer, and he's supposed to be all scared, and they're supposed to come in like, we're a Miami PD. And Malcolm's riffing on the phone, pretending like he's talking to his girlfriend. He's like, hello, love. Ooh, what are you wearing? Oh, the naughty little knickers. And he's going on and on and on. And Caruso's staying there waiting for him to stop. And Malcolm does it. He just keeps going and going. And he goes, hang up the phone. And he's like, hang up the fucking phone. And Malcolm's like, still does it. He's like, oh, kisses, love me. You know, he's just going on and on. It was just hilarious.
Caruso, McDowell.
And you can see all the producers like, oh, God, no.
Yeah, because you guys are going to leave. And
yeah.
Then,
oh, yeah,
and then
we
he's
go
gonna
in there and make
them.
A nightmare for everybody and leave. But it was hilarious.
Stir up the beehive.
It was a good moment. There were some good moments with Michael Madsen and the members of the cast.
Would you want to do a TV show, or is TV
no.
just...
No.
No. Even if it was, like, York, like you said, like, Yorker from the ground up and, like, everything.
I think maybe if it was HBO or something, so you could have some freedom, but network TV was so uptight, we just couldn't figure out what to do half the time.
Well, you know. Let me throw these words at you. Rob Zombie's Shipmates. We bring back Shipmates.
I thought you said Shitmates.
Yeah.
Maybe I just usually hear
well,
it.
Well, if it's on HBO, we can do Shitmates.
We could do Shitmates. We could do Shitmates.
She's two guys that shovel shit for a living.
I was thinking glass coffee table. And never mind.
I think it would be a really awesome show if we did like a reality dating show, but everyone in it was a supernatural creature. And so it was just like... And it's just sort of a side effect of the world, but it's actually a reality dating show, and the whole thing is shot on video, and it's just like, you know, just werewolves dating vampires and aliens and Frankenstein monsters.
Ooh,
oh,
shit!
Yeah.
I don't know. I think TV would be weird just because doing the same characters over and over and over.
I don't know.
Drive me crazy. Because even when we did Halloween 2, at the end of that, we all kind of felt like, enough Michael Myers and Laurie Strode for everybody. You know, you kind of just want to move on. But
I wanted to see, you know, the characters from, like, I was, when Devil's Rejects came out, I was so excited that those characters were coming back. And, like, I wanted the movies to keep going. Yeah. But I know that's kind of part of it, like, you know, leave them wanting more. But, like, I wanted them to just continue.
That one I always kind of wanted to continue a little bit, too, for some reason. That was more fun for some reason.
Well, that's fun. Like, that's a that's a super fun thing. British television does that all the time, where they'll do a series, and then the next version of the series will be a slightly different genre.
Yeah.
Or will focus on another aspect of a smaller thing from the first series. And I feel like we don't do that enough in America, but it's such a cool idea.
I don't think we have the patience for it.
You don't think so?
No. Then people are like, I like this thing. Don't change it.
They're just too afraid.
Yeah. I want 200 episodes of just this episode.
I want Chandler to be funny.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, it's just a different, it's a different bag, man.
Now, I always feel like I'm pretty busy. You are 10 times busier than I am. How the fuck do you... I mean, you're going on tour in a couple days. Actually, yeah, you'll probably be on tour by the time this goes up. So you're going on tour. And I was looking at your calendar on your website. You're going on tour for 4 straight months. It's just 4 months of dates.
Mm-hmm.
Is that... Are you just used to that? Or is it? Does it take a toll where you're like, ah, fuck.
Pretty used to it. It goes by fast. I mean, we used to go out and tour sometimes for 2.5 years solid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we wouldn't come back for 2.5 years, and that just became the way. And then we're like, oh, that's a little crazy, so let's just do 1.5 years. You know, that's why I always think it's funny when, like, sometimes I talk to, not you, but some comedians, like, whew, did a weekend, my god, thank god I'm home. Like, really?
Actually, I think
you just,
I
went,
did
to Chuckles for the weekend.
I think I did leave. We were trading
it's
calls
a harsh room. Chuckles.
We were trading calls once, and I think I left a crazy message on your phone at one point, because I had been performing all weekend, and I was just like, I think I'm freaking out. I don't know. This is a really tough. And it was just like a week's worth of shows.
I mean, you just have to get into the groove, you know. It's like, it is like a circus. You just pack everything up. And even like last night, I was packing up my case, and I'm like staring at my wardrobe case like, well, I guess that's my house for the next 4 months. This little,
let's see, underwear,
crap.
Ventriloquist dummy.
I went on tour for like a month straight once with a band, and it's weird because it seems like so daunting at first, and then, you know, a few days in, it's just the constant motion kind of keeps you distracted from how long it's going
to
take.
I would love to be able to just go out with a tour bus, but I go back and forth doing comedy dates.
Yeah,
and
I mean, that's actually different. It's kind of cool, though. The one thing about touring that I find, I mean, if you're with people you like, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
If you're with people you don't like, that's hell. But, like, when we're on the tour bus, and after we're done playing, we're just, like, watching Curb Your Enthusiasm or something, we're like, what a life is this? You know, it's like everyone can be 15 forever. We really don't have to accomplish much of anything.
Does it feel...
You hear that, yeah, kids?
We just have to, you know, we have to hold it together for that 1.5 hours on stage, and the rest of the time we can be completely useless.
Now, as a musician who's had a bunch of hit songs, I've always wanted to... I've never asked anyone this. What is the thing, like, when you go to a concert and then you kind of want the band to play, like, one of the songs that you love, and then they're kind of like, nah, fuck you, I'm not going to play that song anymore. I try to equate it with jokes, but I guess I'm a whore because I always feel like, ah, I'll just do whatever, you know, like, I'll say the old stuff.
Well, I think that, I mean, I've always been a big, oops, let me answer this.
Excuse me, I'm just doing a quick sonata.
Excuse me. Hello?
Right now, Rob's...
Hey, I'm doing Chris's podcast, and this conversation's part of it.
Can who's Chris?
One as soon as I'm done?
Chris Harder from Shitmates?
Oh.
Okay, bye.
And he's
was it the lovely Sherry Moon Zombie?
Yes, and she doesn't check her texts as much as I do. So, actually, if you listen to the Malcolm McDowell likes to call a lot, and if you listen to the Halloween commentary track, he calls me actually while I'm doing it, and we're talking on the phone about doing it. So.
How's that working out, love?
Anyway, what'd you ask me?
We were just talking about like playing the same, like playing the songs. And
I mean, I've always been a believer in that. A lot of people get really pretentious about this stuff, but I don't. I think, like, if someone comes in and they paid their money, they only paid their money for one reason, and your job is to entertain them.
Mm-hmm.
And if that means playing a song for the 3,000th time, some songs I think I've played that many times, then you just do it.
Yeah.
And you don't go... I'm not up on stage for my own personal gratification. You're there to entertain people. But I'm kind of like... I still think of it as show business. I think a lot of people think of it as their own personal bullshit.
Right.
But I don't think of it that way. And I was just had a long conversation with Alice Cooper, who would go on tour together. And he's very much like that, too. You know, he's like into the idea of show business. And I always thought we were sort of like kindred spirits in that way. And yeah, because he kind of really grew up at that great time period where he was like friends with Groucho Marx and Mae West and was very much in show business. And I just think that's what you do.
He's great. He
bought the O in Hollywood, didn't he, for Groucho? Yeah.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Alice actually did.
That's awesome. Yeah. I worked at a golf course when I was in college, and he's a huge golfer, and he came to that golf course, and the only way that you knew it was Alice Cooper, because his hair was like back and tucked under a hat, and he was dressed like a golfer, but his golf bag had his name dripped in fake blood on it. Like, oh, it's Alice Cooper.
The best is if you see pictures of him from the 70s playing golf, and he's out there, like, the hair's down, he's in cutoff shorts, like, some kind of, like, t-shirt, holding a beer, looking totally like Alice Cooper, but he's, you know, with, like, Bob Hope or something on the golf course.
Well, everyone had cutoff shorts in the 70s. I think that was the only shorts they made in the 70s.
Short, yeah.
But you took me to see his show at the, well, now it's the Gibson Amphitheater, but it was Universal Amphitheater before, and it was phenomenal. Like, he's still super energetic on stage.
Oh, it's great. I mean, he takes it serious, and it'll be a good tour. It's going to be awesome. But
is it just you two?
Yeah, it's just the two of us. So we both do a full set, full setup.
Nice.
But it kind of goes back, but I mean, just to finish answering your question, you just got to do it, right? I mean, that's why you're there. You're not there to not play the songs people want to hear. That's a total ripoff.
Yeah.
And even if you have new songs, it might be kind of fun to play. You got to go, okay, we'll play like two.
Yeah.
I'm not going to bore people, you know, to death.
Bathroom break.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Out of here.
Yeah, maybe the beer line's shorter now.
I mean, you're
playing a new song.
Your live show is pretty intricate. I mean, there's, you know, like there's a lot of shit going on, like on the screens,
yeah,
and
yeah.
then like characters, like, you know, like these massive robot characters. The last time I saw you, and I mean,
I'm always afraid people are going to be bored, so I have like that. You know, I got to keep it like every 2 seconds. So, like, if anything stops, they'll just, you know,
yeah,
they're bored. Quick.
Do you ever
look at that thing?
Yeah.
Here's another thing.
Robot and a note.
Do you ever sort of feel like, ah, fuck, this is, you know, because obviously, I mean, even just doing stand up when it's just you and a mic, shit goes wrong. But when you have a band and characters and video and pyrotechnics and, you know, like, you just sort of roll with it, I guess.
I used to like get really upset if something went wrong. You're like, oh man, you're like, it was like the end of the world. Now I don't really care at all. Because the thing I realized is that nobody notices.
Right.
Like the guitar would go off for like four songs. And you'd be like, oh my God, that's the worst show ever. Then you'd ask somebody at the end, what about when the guitar went off for four songs and every single person goes, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even notice.
I was distracted by all the shit going on.
I was looking
stage.
At the naked dancing girls on the screen.
There was a robot.
Too?
There was a giant robot behind you. I don't know if you saw that.
I should start touring with robots to dance on either side of me while I'm doing jokes.
Agreed.
There was a
pretty amazing.
There used to be this guy, I can't remember what band he was in before, but it was called Captured by Robots, and he was a solo guy with a guitar that had all his all the rest of the music was on a, like, coming from a sequencer, but he had two robots on either side of him with chains, like, connected to him. And, like, throughout the thing, in between his song, he'd, like, argue with the robots that would, like pull him from either side and force him to play music for everybody.
What band was this?
It was called Captured by Robots. And I think it was one of the guys from that band, Skank and Pickle. Like, he quit Skank and Pickle and he just did Captured by Robots. And it's just like, you should look it up. Like, I think he did a tour with Man or Astro Man, like some kind of robot.
That's totally genius.
But it's just like, yeah, like it was just like, yeah.
By the way, I'm glad I had to ask what the name of the band was. What was the name of that band where the guy was captured by robots?
Oh, yeah. Slippy Sales. And
the Slippy Sales.
And the Saladin 3.
So what is it that you think that drives you to stay? Because your schedule pretty much seems to be, you know, like, record an album, write a movie, direct a movie, go on tour, make another album, do another movie. Like,
pretty much.
What is it that you know, like, why? Because I often wonder, why do I plan my life so that I have zero free time? What do you think that is?
My theory is that when you do what you love for a living, what do you do in your free time?
Yeah.
Not do all the things you love to do. Like, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, because when I'm not, you know, actually writing music or playing music or touring or writing a movie or filming the movie, so I'd go insane. So that's just start out of the projects. Like, I have a new comic project that's coming out next month, and that was because I had 5 minutes off and kind of started losing my mind. So I was like, oh, let's quick start a project. I just can't bear the idea of not having a reason to get out of bed to work.
Yeah.
And I always thought that it seemed as if, I hope this theory holds some water, but that the people that worked until they died, like George Burns, Bob Hope, they live forever because you can tell, Jesus, I'm late. I got a gig, you know, I'm 99 years old, but I got to be at the Sands.
Right.
But I see when people retire and they go from 60 to 80 in a month.
Like, yeah.
Johnny Carson.
They don't even know how to.
Seriously.
Yeah.
No, he really
they have no reason to. You kind of have no reason to live. I mean, I live for what I do. That's all I really want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to force myself to. I mean, I do like take time off now because that's what when we moved out of LA. But even then, it's like I look like, wait, great, I got a month off. I can watch like 80 movies and recharge my battery. You know, like that time to suck in more influences and just ideas and things.
And you don't there isn't really, I mean, from what I notice about you, there isn't really anyone who works really directly under you. Pretty much do everything yourself.
Yeah, I mean, starting off, you have no money, you have no nothing. So it's right. Just like the punk rock thing. You do everything yourself. You make the flyers, you plaster them on the wall, you run from the cops when they try to bust you, and you just stick with that attitude. And then when we signed to Geffen, I thought, oh, great, we're signed to Geffen Records. It's going to be a whole team of people doing everything for us. And I quickly realized, no, there is nobody's going to do anything. I mean, because you walk in these offices and you look around and go like, nobody in this office could give two fucks if I become a rock star.
Right.
And give a shit who I am or if I do anything. And that's when I was like, oh, man, if you want to make it happen, you better do it yourself. And now I'm just figured out a way to do everything myself. I mean, I have like a small core group of people that three or four people that between those three or four people, we can pretty much accomplish everything. But it was funny. Yeah, because people always think like, you have like this office of people, and it's basically me like this, yeah, doing it myself. But it's better that way.
And you always, and I feel like movies were kind of always the thing. It seems like movies were always the thing that you wanted to do. That music was just sort of, was that a side thing or what? Because you literally have every horror movie ever made in your house in L.A. in a giant closet of DVDs.
Yeah. It was always everything, though. I mean, I kind of tried to keep that. I think sometimes you can really benefit from being completely naive as to how the world works. Because if someone explains to you the reality of what you want to do, you go, forget it. I can't do that.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. I'm not going to be an astronaut.
I will.
Fastronaut!
Everything wrong except the deeper. Something like that.
Who's the jerk?
Yeah.
Yes.
I failed everything but the date of birth.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had that little kid mentality. When I was a little kid, you have those books when you're a little kid. You put your first grade picture and it says, what do you want to be when you grow up? Huh? And you fill it out. And I wanted to make movies, do music, make comics, and have monsters around. Like, this kind of like crazy ideas. And I just sort of stuck to it. Really, like, why can't I do everything? Because people are like, well, you can't do this because of that. I go, well, why? Who fucking gives a shit? I can do everything I want.
Yeah. And you went to school for graphic design, though, right?
Yeah, I went to Parsons School of Design for a year and a half. And the day the teachers brought in their work was the day I just zoned out.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, because I thought, like, oh, my God, I suck. This guy's like a genius. He's telling me my work is this, that, and the other thing. Oh, my God, I'm not good enough to be here. And then he brings in his work. And I'm like, you fucking cunt. That fucking bullshit, you like hot glued a fucking fuzzy piece of shit to a piece of cardboard. I'm out of here.
Nice.
It was a joke. It was a real eye-opener, though, as to what a scam it was. But it was worth it because the only people I learned from, there were some other kids there who were so phenomenally talented that you go, oh, shit, this guy's like, you know, 18 and he's brilliant. So that's really was what I got out of school.
And do you feel like it's better to, you know, because when you're starting in the 80s, it's not like, hey, I have all this home recording equipment that doesn't cost any money. Like, you really kind of have to get studio time, and you have to, you know, like, it's expensive. It's more expensive to start doing that stuff in the 80s.
Yeah, I often wonder if it's, yeah, I mean, like, making movies was impossible. Like, I made some, like, in the 80s when I was in high school, but it's like, just to get the camera and the film and develop it was like, where am I going to get this money? This could cost up to $40, you know? Right. So that was a nightmare. And same with recording and everything else. I mean, early days of White Zombie, we would do all kinds of fishy stuff. Like, somebody would be like, this band left their gear backstage, and I have the keys. So we'd go steal it.
Nice.
Like, horrible stuff like that, you know? Like,
Jesus Christ.
Hey, look where I am.
So if you're out there, failed band.
Yeah. If anyone's amp was missing from a club in 1984...
Yeah, I'm starting the band White Zombie Stole My Fucking Gear. All the songs are about how
so
White
you just
kind of
do whatever you got to do. I was so broke, I remember when we signed to Geffen, I would treat their lounge as if it was a supermarket. Going with a knapsack and just be like... And then I would take all the CDs, like, Guns N' Roses and stuff and just go directly to Aaron's, which is gone, but
yeah.
That's how I lived off selling the catalog out of the Geffen closet.
I remember
it's weird, every time that whistling guy comes around
the closet's
a lot
empty.
Of money.
I when I was working at a record store in Venice Beach, like there would just be guys like bands, just broke bands, like they would just come and bring their CDs, like just the like all the promo discs from. They would just like load up, and just we would sometimes not have to buy new stock because like we knew they were going to come in and just like backlog all of our
all
like,
the bar, CDs. All the barcodes.
Oh my god, that totally,
out.
That totally happened when I worked at K-Rock in LA. The interns would take the just crates of the promotional CDs. Yeah.
I did that at the college radio station. I didn't go to college, but I used to hang out at the college radio station in Hawaii.
Close enough.
I started hanging out with this one guy, then he made me the co-host, and then sometimes he would just wouldn't show up, so I had my own radio station without having to go to schooling.
Nice.
But like I remember like they would get rid of a bunch of their like CDs, and I would just nab them, put them on a cassette tape, and then sell them.
Sick thing is I still do that.
Oh,
I still do that. Yeah, like we're like, I'll go like, hey, there's like 10 boxes of one sheets for Halloween 2. Put them in my car. And I will sign them and sell them on tour or something.
Nice.
Penny Pincher always a penny pincher.
Yeah, I know, but at least in that case, people who come to your shows are getting something cool.
Well,
that
they see something ready to go in the dumpster, and I see like a pile of money sitting there.
Brendan Small like sells tons of stuff, like because he gets so many like promotional things for Metalocalypse.
Oh yeah,
he now just like is like constantly on eBay, just like selling stuff that he signs, like drumsticks and just whatever.
Worth it.
I should start selling the Chris Hardwick hosting mic. Well, let's get a little microphone with my picture on it.
Be just like Chris Hardwick.
Even though I don't hold a mic on camera at all.
So I think if you once never had any money or was paranoid about it happening again.
Oh, yeah. I'm so constantly always, I mean, look, they say that about Leno, like he's got hundreds of millions of dollars, but he's still like,
I don't spend the Tonight Show money.
And Groucho Marx was another guy that was always paranoid because he lost a bunch of money in the stock market.
Yes, he did.
A lot.
He was the only one who had any money left.
Afterwards,
like, Harpo and whatever. We can go to the Marx Brothers later.
No, we can always talk about the Marx Brothers.
Words.
Are you ever going to make any? Are you thinking? Because you made El Super Bisto, which was super fun. Mike Furman and I did the music for that.
Hard and firm.
Hard and firm.
Tore it up.
Tearing it up. Do you ever? Do you think you'll ever make like a live action comedy, or do you? Is it something you?
I would like to. I sort of had a 3-stage plan with El Super Bisto, and I thought like. Make a comic book, turn it into an animated movie, and turn the animated movie into a live-action movie. Mm-hmm. And that's why I tried to cast everyone who kind of looked like the part they were playing.
Yeah.
Thinking, what if you made this live-action movie with the same people who did the voices?
Yeah.
Of course, you'd have to put Tom Papa in like some kind of muscle suit. But other than that, everyone else kind of looks the same.
Get him away from the marriage ref.
Yeah. Sure.
Please.
I have to go be a filthy wrestler. Fuck a lot of porno chicks. Tom's great. I love.
He's hilarious. Yeah.
He's hilarious. Is Marriage Ref still on?
I don't know. Is it?
Yeah, it is. I just saw it.
Has it ever really been on though?
No, it has been on.
Has it?
Television.
Has it though?
Yeah, but Jonah has.
Though hasn't it? Nint?
Well, I guess if you put it that way.
That contraction at the end really.
Well,
sold
see
me.
You guys later.
Has anything ever really on?
What do you say to someone? Just asked me the other day. You're like, oh, what do I do if I want to start hosting stuff? And I'm like, I don't know, make a
hosting reel,
make a, like, you can put stuff on the internet now, why don't you just stuff?
Yeah, that kind of goes back to what you're saying, like, what I think, some I don't, I wonder if, you know what I think it is a little bit, and well, like, what do I know about anything, but I feel like when it was harder to do stuff, that immediately separated some people who were never going to do it,
right?
You know, because it was already so hard to get to point A that it got rid of half, you know. Now anyone can start shooting their little web videos, and it kind of like floods it with people of, you know, there's some talent lost out in there probably, but you know, it doesn't thin the herd quite as much as it used to, because it used to really, you know, quickly like, hey, we got to get in the van and drive to Minneapolis. I quit. I'm going to keep my job at 7-Eleven. I quit. Like any little hardship would make people quit, and now it's a little easier, but I don't know that all that stuff helps. I think it just... And when anyone asks... It's funny. I had the same conversation with Wayne yesterday about this, when people are like, I want to do effects for movies. And I'm almost felt that as soon as someone asks you for advice, they're not going to do it.
Right.
The people who are going to do it are already doing it.
Right.
I never asked anybody anything. You probably never... I mean, you just do it.
Right.
Those people somehow instinctively know what to do. They know. They don't hand or you their demo. They don't tell you about their non-existent
projects. They just try stuff. I mean, people just do it. Yeah. People always say... And
Nike had a good idea with that.
I think starting stand-up is probably the easiest thing of all, because all you have to do is just start doing it.
It's like, easy, but it's frightening.
I mean, just in terms of, like, logistically, it's...
Yeah, you just show up with a
You don't have to assemble a crew. You don't have to shoot anything and edit anything. You just start going up.
I found it harder to start stand-up than it was for me to ever, like, start a band growing up. Like, starting a band, it's like this is fun. It's like hanging out with your friends, but you have something to show for it. Like, stand-up was such a lonely, solitary thing. It's like, I'm just going to go to this open mic at this coffee shop by myself on Pico.
Yeah.
And
I can't blame it on the drummer if it goes
exactly.
badly.
That's the thing. That was the weirdest part about going from, like, just growing up playing music to, like, doing stand-up, where it's just like, if you fuck up, you can't go, ha, oh, no. Like, you know, you're just by yourself up there.
Back me up on this guy. Ah, there's nobody back there.
Yeah. Lonely.
Well, yeah.
It does seem really hard.
And it's also unrewarding, too. Like, you have to, and I'm sure this is true for you, too. With anything, you really have to be in love with the process. Because that's the goal at the end isn't really going to always be the thing that's rewarding.
And sometimes there is no goal at the end.
Yeah. But,
you know, you just have to this is the way I always looked at it, and I think everyone who does it does. You do it because you have to, and if you can't do it, you would rather be dead.
Right. Yeah.
Like if someone says to me, oh, what if you couldn't do music? I'd rather be dead. You know, like, I do it because that's what I want to do. It's not because of, like, that's the only thing that fuels the reason why you feel like you're alive. And I felt like that as a little kid. Like, these were the things I was so obsessed with, and if I couldn't have these things, I didn't care about anything else.
Yeah, I remember like there was a thing in school once where it's like, would life be like worth, like, you know, it's like, would life be as exciting if it weren't for music? And I remember I was like one of the only kids that put like no. And the kid's like, what do you mean? I was like, imagine like Star Wars starting, and then right when it says Star Wars, it's like, it's just nothing. It's just the, like, you know, blink, and instead of like, you know, so the music coming in, like, it makes things that much better. And like any kind of art and entertainment will always make things worth living.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think
not
I
a
truly,
fucking tree.
This probably sounds people will think this sounds stupid. I think that the only thing that makes life worth living is art. And people that have that always seem excited to be alive. And the people that don't, they get that kind of like, they always seem disappointed in life. Like, well, getting a new car really didn't do it, and having kids really didn't cut it, and working in that factory didn't. You know, but it's like, there's just because the art kind of creates something, the potential of something greater than yourself that you will always be striving for, that you'll never achieve.
No.
The psycho perfection that you want, that you'll never achieve.
Have you sort of made peace with that, or do you feel like, do you still emotionally reward yourself along the way? Because it's really hard, because when you're constantly critical of what you do of your own work, and you're constantly critical of, oh, this didn't go right, how can this be better? I mean, like, do you ever kind of like?
Well, I feel yes, in the sense that, and I think that you suffer from this badly. I noticed that you will never finish it because you think you can make it better, and then it just doesn't happen. I mean, not always, but I mean, remember when we were talking about making a comedy record, I was like, Chris, I just saw you be fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
Just fucking record it.
Yeah, this was... Yeah, well, that was... Yeah. Those were in the old...
Done.
These were in the old drinking days. Rob offered to produce a stand-up album for me like 7 years ago. And I was like, okay, but it's not ready yet. And then ultimately the opportunity just passed because his relationship with... I think it was Warner Brothers Records. It was Geffen. And so it just... I was just so worried about it being perfect that I never finished it. And... I mean, fortunately, I've changed a lot since then.
And you know what? I was the same way. Like, it'd be – and I think what made it change for me was, if you do something long enough, say you've been making music for 10 years, and everything that you fucking hated that you did 10 years ago, you don't listen for a long time. You go back and listen, and you go like, that's actually kind of cool. I don't know why I was beating myself up over it so hard.
Yeah.
And it's like that with the movies and anything. It's like you just and then you go, man. Sometimes you can't realize what it is. And what you hate about it is exactly what someone else likes about it, because it's such an intangible quality that you'll go, no, the reason I liked it, it sounded like shit. It just sounded so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes people, I was trying to mix it and it came out terrible. I'm glad, you know.
Yeah.
It just
sometimes shit comes out lo-fi and that's what people like, you know.
Yeah, and then you make it all perfect and like, man, nah, I don't like
it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and also what I've realized is it's better to, you know, it's better to make stuff and then, I mean, obviously, you should want it to be good. You should work hard on it, but not getting to that sort of perfection fantasy, because you make stuff, and then if it's not perfect, then you learn from it, and then the next thing you make is, you know, I'm sure your learning curve between movies was amazing.
I mean, totally. And I mean, if you felt you got it perfect, then I figure, like, I guess quit.
Yeah.
If it's perfect. And I think the other thing, too, is that you have to decide, like, well, who – you're making it for two different people. Like, you can secretly, I don't know, see what you've done and go, I see all the flaws in it. I'm going to fix that next time. But keep it to yourself, basically.
Yeah.
Because someone else, and I always notice that with every record, if I go, this is the best song we've ever written, everyone goes, yeah, that song kind of sucks. Yeah. Then there's this other song I think is total crap. They're like, that's the greatest song
I
you've ever written.
I shit that riff out in a minute. Yeah. Why?
And then you just go, there's no, it doesn't matter because they have no perspective on it. And,
same thing with jokes. Whenever I write a joke that I think is, oh my God, this is going to be this a slaughterhouse, it always dies. And then the sort of thrown out there stuff is what people hook onto. And I guess maybe it comes from a different place in my brain. Stuff that I like might be too inside my own head for other people.
Yeah, and or maybe it's just not the time for that joke to hit, and it'll seem – I don't know. I think there's a real danger in overthinking it. I know a lot of people – and I probably used to do that, but I've gotten over it where like they overthink it to the point where they don't even do it.
Yeah.
Because they talk themselves out of it. Whatever happened, I think, I just thought about it too and decided not to do it.
Do you still get up in the morning? Because, you know, for a while you – at least when you're writing the movie, I don't know if you're doing this when you're not working on a movie, but you would get up, you know, you'd wake up at like 5 or 6 and just start writing.
Yeah, I still do that because I figure that if I get up super early and write, I can always like solve all the problems the night before. I'm like, oh, I don't know, it doesn't make sense. Because your brain just does seem fresh. I guess you're refreshed because you slept. But then as the phone starts ringing and the dog's barking and you have breakfast and you get done, you know, answer a few emails, you're like, oh, forget it. My brain's like screwed now.
Yeah. So it really is just a little bit of just working a little bit at a time without necessarily.
I mean, I always think of everything as like baby steps because sometimes people go, well, how'd you get all this stuff? And I go, well, if you get up every morning and you wrote 2 pages, in 2 months your script's done.
Yeah.
And then if you just keep doing it, like, it's weird. But you think, but a lot of people I know that have that problem, that they think about the having the script done. I go, well, that'll make you not do it.
Yeah.
You just got to do it, and tomorrow there'll be 2 pages, 4 pages, 10 pages, 20, you know. And that's just basically how I do everything. Because sometimes if I do look at the list of things I have to accomplish at any given time where it's like I got to finish the script, I have to design all the merch for a tour, I got to do the songs, got to write this, and I was like, my brain hurts looking at the list. But then I realize, well, they're not all due on the same day.
Right.
You know, that's what we'd say with movies, because sometimes on the movie set you get overwhelmed, but then you go, well, we only shoot them one day at a time. I'm not going to worry about this scene that's not what I'm going to get to for like 3 weeks. I'll worry about it on the morning when Weird Al and Chris show up.
That's right. David Allen getting things done.
Which was a complex scene.
He says you got to break things down into bite-sized chunks.
Yeah, it's true. So that's my time management.
Hey, I always love talking to you about those early Comic Cons because you went to Comic Cons when you were a little kid.
Oh yeah, they were funny.
What were they like in the early 70s? What were the Comic Cons like?
Well,
proto nerds basically.
Well, the first one I ever went to, a Star Trek convention in Philadelphia in 1976.
Wow. Nice.
So that was like 76 was kind of like
Philly in 76. Like that's the place where you want to be.
Oh, it was the Bicentennial Con.
Yeah, so, shit. Nice.
Yeah, so I have the program book and it was all bicentennialed out. And I still remember, let's see.
Patriotic nerds.
Yeah, and that was like the boom of Star Trek, the second wave. Remember when the Mego action figure time period was around 76 when it kind of hit huge in syndication?
That's true.
And I remember it was I was so thrilled to be. It was George Takei when he had long hair and big sideburns.
Oh, yeah.
Like when he was still like that
it's
style.
It's Takei. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, Matt. Just
You're right.
Nerd fight.
You're right. An apology not accepted.
Who's there? Grace Lee Whitney and like Harlan Ellison.
Janice Rand.
But it was pretty crazy.
And then, so what were the... Because now there's... I mean...
But I actually found all the pictures I took with my little camera.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was like, oh my God, these are even weird. I look, you know, at George Takei with his huge white bell bottoms and everything.
Wow.
Doing magic tricks on
stage.
Did
you dress up? George Takei was doing magic tricks on stage?
With some other guy because they had a magician. Like, they had all this weird stuff. Like, they had, like, acid rock bands and, like, space outfits playing.
They didn't know what to do in those early
70s, and they had just started this thing.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's the Comic-Cons are totally different now. Yeah. And, like, every major studio was there promoting every major thing.
Oh, then there was almost nothing to buy. Nobody was promoting anything. It was just like, hey, this is my fanzine. And
just people, just nerds trying to connect.
Yeah. It was awesome. I loved it. Because that was at the point, this sounds so bad, pathetic nerdness, but... You know, like you're in school, you can't relate to anything. And then you go to this place where everyone's fucking weirdo and no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And there's no internet, and the only way that you can connect with people is to go out of, you know, to drive an hour to Philadelphia. Yeah.
That's kind of how I felt about, like, the punk scene when I first started going to punk shows, which is, like, I didn't get along with anyone in school. And then, like, I randomly go to a show at a cafeteria, like, on a Friday night at high school in the next town. And, like, it was just like, holy shit, I know that band on that shirt. Like, it was just, it's like going to a place where you all of a sudden find this community. Yeah. It's a good feeling. I don't know if kids will find that anymore, though, with the internet. Do you think that'll happen?
Well, I think they find it on the internet.
Well, I think they just take it for granted a little bit more.
I think that's the one thing about the internet that's really bad is that, you know, like, when I moved to New York, that was that feeling. Like, you go to New York, you're like, oh, my God, everyone's a freak. And the more freak you are, the more they like you.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, people making fun of stuff about you and you can't even figure out, like, wait, there's two stripes on my Adidas, so I'm gay. I don't understand what's happening here.
Sorry, I have a giant cock, everyone. So sick of being made fun of for that. So sick of it. Yeah, it looks like a soup can, okay? It looks like two soup cans.
Women don't want that, Chris.
Sorry. Arizona iced tea can.
But now I think that forced you to get out and go find those people and move away from your shit small town and do something. And I think in a lot of ways, I know a lot of people where the internet, it makes them not feel so alone because it's so easy to connect to those people, but you don't
make them
really
go out.
Yeah, you can sort of like feel safe from the comfort of your bedroom. And I think it actually pulls you deeper into a hole. Yeah. Not everybody, that's not saying everyone, but I'm saying, like, you know, for me, I was shy and withdrawn and would have just been happy to do that, but you go, well, I don't want to sit around here with some fucking asshole who doesn't ever talk to anyone. I'm going to force myself to get a life.
Yeah.
But sometimes the internet lets you not have to get a life.
Yeah.
I have this theory that those big-eyed little bald aliens that people always see are actually future humans. That's how we evolved. Those giant eyes from staring at screens and the big heads because we're isolated and don't have to deal with each other.
Very pale and thin.
Yeah, isn't that one of the theories, though, that, like, that's a way, like, they time travel back?
That's the theory I'm going with.
Yeah.
Works for me.
Yep.
Wait, if that's the case,
you're listening
then we
to the
really
Art Bell Show. Bringing it around,
Bell.
Jonah Ray. I just brought it around to Art fucking Bell.
Wow.
You get him on sometime.
I thought he got abducted.
What?
I thought he got abducted.
He got abducted.
Oh, he got abducted.
They're good bit.
So anything else? What are you working on next after the 4-month tour? Do you write when you're on tour or do you just focus on tour?
No, I write.
Yeah,
because I have to. Because everyone expects me to come off tour with a script, which I always do. But
what do you do when you feel overwhelmed? Some days I just feel like I don't know if I could get through this.
I usually do this. I kind of sit there for a minute and go like, "Oh, God." All right, enough of that.
Yeah,
that's what I usually do.
You do need to take those moments, though. Like you do need to take, like, you know, like just a moment to just go, "Fuck, okay, let's go." You know?
Yeah, I mean, because you really don't have. That, like, especially if you're in the middle of directing a movie, sometimes you do feel overwhelmed because what happens too is you're not sleeping.
Yeah.
Because you're working like 18-hour days and stuff. And sometimes you just have to go on your trail and be like, and then need it on set. Oh, God, here we go. Game face.
Hello, everyone.
Almost had time to pee that one.
Action. Action in the crowd.
Background. Pantomime people. Pantomime. All
of this food is really good. That's a joke that would only work for us, I realized, before I got into it. I was about to do the bad background extra.
Yeah, pantomime jokes don't work so good.
Internet radio.
Not so good for audio. This has been awesome. I thank you for...
Was that a quick hour?
Yeah, that was a quick hour. Oh, what are you working on? What are you working on after the tour? That's what I asked you.
What am I doing? Basically trying to figure out what the next movie is. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of what I'm doing here in LA for the next couple of days. I want to go lock down, like, okay, because I have several projects and I don't know which one is going to go next. I want to go, okay, I know this is next. So when I come off tomorrow, here's the script done, boom, go into production on that. Probably early 2011 though, because the touring will probably go till November.
Yeah.
Because there's more to come than what was out there.
I got asked, what's some of your favorite horror movies in the past couple of years that have come out?
I tend to always avoid going to horror movies for the most part.
Yeah.
It's like really something I've kind of like burnt out on.
Yeah.
Like, what did you think of Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell, or did you see House of the Devil?
I didn't see that. Drag Me to Hell, I didn't get. Like, people were like, oh my God. And I watched it. I was like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I thought Let the Right One In was really cool.
Oh my God. That was amazing. The was it the Swedish?
Swedish
vampire movie?
They've already remade it.
Yeah.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. I think it's just called Let Me In. They changed the title or something.
Get me in that house! It's starring Chris Tucker as a vampire.
Let the right motherfucker in!
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth? Let me in!
You understand the fangs that are coming out of my mouth?
I'm curious if... Because obviously, you know, there's such a... And then we'll wrap it up and let you go. But there's such a drive now for people to just be famous. Like, that's what kids in schools are just saying. They want to be famous.
Yeah.
And, you know... Is there anything that you would say to people, like, once you sort of achieve a certain level of fame, and it might not be exactly what you think it's going to be, like, what, I don't know, what?
I mean, I never did anything because I wanted to be famous.
Right.
You know, I don't think anybody, I don't think you did, anyone who, you did it because you love comedy, or you love movies, or you love music, and you go, well, if I make some money and someone gives a shit who I am, that's a bonus too. Yeah, but I mean, that's kind of like a new, kind of, we're talking about the bug-eyed aliens. That's kind of like a new creature, people that are just famous for being famous.
Yeah.
Like, you're famous because you have too many kids.
Right.
Great. Yeah. Can't wait to see what you're up to in 20 years. Huh. You know, right.
What's your next project? Yeah. Oh, more kids? Yeah, that's good.
Good.
I wouldn't call a pregnancy a project in development. That seems to underscore the gift of life.
I think the problem all those people are going to have, unless they're already rich, is who the hell wants that kind of fame with no money?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like when you see, you know, like Joey Buttafuoco riding the subway. Like,
yeah.
Don't want to be that guy.
Boy, he really let himself go. Oh, wait. He always let himself go.
Oh, wait. He's not really famous for anything.
His whole life was letting go.
Yeah. Don't you find yourself doing this all the time? Like, who is that?
Oh.
What do they do?
Constantly. Yeah.
I guess they just shop on TV.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Or they have.
I still don't know what that Justin Bieber Berber kid does.
Berber.
I don't know what he does.
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I think he's
Takei.
I think he's
Takei.
Takei.
Bieber.
As in Takei.
Bebel.
Well, good luck on the tour, and hopefully I'll catch up with you this summer at some point. I mean, you don't even live in LA anymore.
No, you can come out to the lake and rock out on the jet ski.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rob taught me how to jet ski on Ski-Doo. It was really awesome.
It's basically grab this, squeeze it, and hold on.
And don't die.
I like the water that shoots out of the back.
Although I did take Janet out for a fast ride.
Oh, my girlfriend.
Almost
Janet, yeah.
Catapulted her off the back. And she was laughing because I think she thought, he knows what he's doing. But I was like,
yes,
snap.
I know what I'm doing.
Take it below 70 miles an hour on the turn.
Let me just turn. I'll just make a U shape, and we'll collect the lower part of your leg over there, and we'll reattach that somehow.
This was no boating accident.
Perfect way to end.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Close the beaches.
Thanks, Rob.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Every year, 50 teenage girls, one from every state, show up in Mobile, Alabama to compete in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. They spend months training to win the big prize. But what happens when a Supreme Court decision leaves many of them feeling unprepared for the real world?
A lot of the girls were crying, and I never seen any of them cry before.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shima Oliai. Follow me behind the scenes as all 50 girls are catapulted into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. What do they think of their changing country? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.